We come to this message, the rules of war. War is part and parcel of a nation. Like it or not, you will face with war. If you don't want war, others will just come and swallow you up and subjugate it. That was what it was like in the old days. As we proceed, you are going to see that is the case. And thus far, the laws of Moses were being expounded on the plains of Moab just before the Israelites crossed over the Jordan. Moses knew very well that God gave this law in order that the nation of Israel might function as a nation separated unto himself. And it therefore had to be different in the way of handling even a war. They were not to behave like the pagans around them who did not know God. But neither did it mean that just because they knew the true God, they were just to have a holy huddle that everything is well. But what do you do when the enemy is attacked? Then you discover that you can't just pray to God. God, we know that God can deal with the enemies in his own ways, but it is God's chosen ways that he makes use of human means. So that's why we say there's divine sovereignty, there's also human responsibility. And human responsibility is used by God in his sovereignty. So we are fully responsible for our actions, and yet it fulfills God's purpose. So in chapter 19 to chapter 26, we are looking at the administration of the civil and criminal justice coming. And so we see here the application of the law. The law meaning the Ten Commandments. So the Ten Commandments are being expounded or applied to the different situations faced by the nation of Israel. So tonight we come to this talk where the second table of the law is now being applied. What is the second table of the law? The Jews believe that when God gave the Ten Commandments to Moses, it was divided into half and half. The first five commandments were in the first table of the law. The next five commandments were in the second table of the law. So when we refer to the first table of the law, we refer to the first five. And when we refer to the second table of the law, we refer to the last five. But theologically speaking, we see that the first four concerns our relationship with God. The second part, consisting of six, namely commandment number 5 to number 10, concerns our interaction with men. So from the writings of scholars, we often refer to the first four commandments as the first table of the law, and the last six commandments as the second table of the law. Okay? So tonight in this chapter on rules concerning war, the rule regarding commandment number 6 is in view. And commandment number 6 tells us you must not murder. So how do we deal with or apply this commandment to the life of the nation? And we do know that when we come to the New Testament, we see that the civil authority is given the power of the sword, which means that the civil authority alone can take lives. So individuals are no more to avenge the death of anybody in the family, unlike in the Old Testament. In our previous study, we learned that cities of refuge had to be built so that when a person accidentally killed someone, he could run there in order to wait for the courts to meet and to determine whether he was guilty or not. And if he was found guilty, he would be taken back to the city where he came from, and the avenger of blood, which means that a family member appointed for this purpose would be the first to kill the person as punishment. So that was in the Old Testament days. But today, no Christian could take anybody's life, the authority to take anybody's life as punishment for serious crimes would be in the hand of the civil authority, as taught in Romans 13 verse 4. The the civil authority does not wield the sword in vain. Then we come to the situation of war. We realize that the war results in killing as well. So far we have learned of many situations where death can occur. See? Accidental death, which today is called manslaughter, deliberate killing of someone, that is murder, together death and murder would be dealt with by the law under personal or civil justice. Okay? But the civil authority only are allowed to carry out the punishment, although it involves individuals. But there are situations where a country is at war with another, so we have to be involved in killing, so death will occur as well. Then there are unusual situations where we are being attacked by robbers, for example. See? Then somebody might be killed in self-defense. So all together, all these deaths would be under what is called homicide. Homo sapiens are dying. Yeah? You know, Homo sapiens is a reference to human beings. So homicide, all categories of these killings. And tonight's emphasis is on war. And war brings out the worst in mankind. Even in modern wars, we discover the worst came out. And in this part of the world, people cannot forget the Second World War. And always we remember the atrocities committed by the Japanese. And any modern new generation of Japanese hearing this, they will cringe, they feel so embarrassed. And but they have to face up with the fact that just a generation ago, their fathers were in a war that was really very bad. The killings was really bad, and the atrocities were really bad. And we have friends and relatives who were the victims of the war. Yeah? And when you know that, you will understand why the previous generation of people hate the Japanese, and up to today, many in China still hate the Japanese. So over here, we must try to understand, although we don't want to get carried away by human passion, but equally, it would be naive for us to think of nothing of why it is that people are so hateful of the Japanese. Of course, we don't want to put the sin of the previous generation on the present generation, but we must learn from all this. And as a human being, you have to interact. In our previous church camp, we say the Bible's truth must be applied in these three areas, in your home, in your place of work, and in the church. So often it is what you are in your home will be reflected in the church and in the place of work. Similarly, in society, if you work in a big corporate company, your assessment for your promotion and your future path, career path will be looked at from this perspective. Your bosses wouldn't be looking at your professional life only. Oh, you're so good at your work. Well, that is the first place they look at, but they would look at your family life as well. If your family life is bad, your wife is always having a quarrel with you, you're always being driven out of the house, they know that you're going to be a problem in the company. Then they will, plot your career path along a different direction. You will not be able to rise as fast as you otherwise would. Similarly, in the church, we often assess, we see in your career and in your interaction with people in society. For example, when a person is being appointed to be an elder of the church, based on 1 Timothy chapter 3, he has to rule his household well. So if his household is in chaos, then that he will be a problem to being appointed as an elder. See? And similarly, if he does not have a good reputation outside, then he will be a problem in the church. And similarly, church membership, we don't just assess these areas only when appointing a person to office in the church, but even in church membership, we see potential problems coming. See? You see people who don't fare well in the place of work and who do not do well in their family, you discover they're going to be a problem in the church as well. See? So the Bible's truth must be applied to all round. We don't compartmentalize our Christian life, where on Sunday and in church only we behave well, but in the home we are a monster. That cannot be. So you must be careful. And this teaching, this awareness that the Bible's teaching must affect all areas of our life, will help you in not just in the church. It will help you elsewhere as well. So one day as you are beginning your career, you come to realize that your company is not just looking for your professional skill. Oh, how good you are. So they are looking at how well you interact with others as well. During lunch break, for example, do you gather together with your colleague? During tea time, do you interact with your colleague? If you just keep to yourself and you want to continue to do work as though you are so hardworking, people are not interested in that. You see, there's a limit to how hardworking you can be. They observe that you are such a social outcast, doing things all on your own and not being able to interact with others. That is a negative mark for you. Young people in the church, you see, you benefit from teaching like this because the Bible's teaching is being applied in various areas of our lives. So when we come to this passage, we must see that the sixth commandment, you must not murder, is expounded in different areas, and especially in this area of handling war. God's people must behave in a certain way. We can't behave like those who do not know God. So here we are going to see the idea that justice must be tempered with mercy in war as well as in peace. We often hear this statement being made in times of peace. The law courts must temper justice with mercy. Now, to have justice in the law courts means that the judge must keep to the rule of law. If the law requires this punishment, then this punishment must be meted out. You can't be squeamish. You can't say, I pity the person, But if he deserves that, you must pass down that judgment. But at the same time, you must be merciful in the sense that if his wrong does not deserve a punishment heavier than you're giving, then you're not showing mercy. Sometimes people see the range of punishment. They mete out a punishment simply to make others fear. Now, to make others fear committing that same sin is a secondary effect. The deterrent effect is a secondary outcome of upholding justice. You don't purposely give a heavy judgment upon the person with the view of frightening others from committing the same sin. Then that person might be receiving more heavy for what he has committed than is necessary. Then there's no more tempering justice with mercy. So you see now, this teaching is to be upheld in the civil courts, but it is also a principle that must be applied in war as well. So in war, remember, we are not asking you to be squeamish, frightening, having compassion at the wrong time. When you need to shoot the enemy, shoot! Otherwise you will die. So it's war. So war is war, the rules of war apply. So you either kill or be killed. So you must say that there is such a thing as the need to be decisive and to do what needs to be done. But on the other hand, after the enemy is defeated, you don't come and chop up their bodies, showing spite. Now, some people step on the those who are already defeated, squeeze, that type of attitude shows a lack of mercy. And then the plunder, we are going to learn that there are such a thing as plunder, which is legitimately yours in the Old Testament war. All wars fought were with this understanding that when you have defeated your enemies, the plunder belongs to the victor. You see, how do you handle such plunder? You must be careful. Don't behave like the pagans. Okay? So basically, the wars were unavoidable in the old days, but God is putting a limit to the propensity in humans to be cruel, to be extreme. That doesn't mean that you show compassion at the wrong time and for the wrong reason. Then you will never win the war. So understand this. So justice is justice, mercy is mercy, and they are not in conflict with one another. Show justice when justice is needed. Show mercy when mercy is needed. Great wisdom is needed in determining when justice needs to be meted out, when mercy needs to be shown. Okay? So there are two parts, preparation for war, verse 1 to verse 9, and the conduct of war, verse 10 to verse 20. Now, in the first four verses, Israel was assured of God's presence. They were God's special people. If you were to look back at chapter 7, verse 7, you remember that the Lord was giving this admonition to the nation of Israel. He told them at that time, "The Lord did not set his love on you, nor choose you because you were more in number than any other people, for you were the least of all peoples, but because the Lord loves you and because he would keep the oath which he swore to your fathers, the Lord has brought you out with a mighty hand and redeemed you with the house of bondage, from the house of bondage and from the hand of Pharaoh, king of Egypt." So why was Israel chosen to be God's special covenant people? You know what is meant by covenant, don't you? Huh? It means a special formal agreement, a perjanjian. So it is a formal agreement between two or more parties. So God entered into this formal agreement with the nation that they will be specially his people and he will specially be their God. Why was the nation of Israel chosen out of all nations in the world? Was it because they were better than others? No. It was simply because God just chose to place his love upon them. It wasn't because of any good found in them. And God has given this promise to Abraham. And this promise was now being fulfilled in his descendants. See? So the nation of Israel, who were descended from Abraham, must remember they were chosen not because they were better than other nations and not because they were stronger than other nations. God simply had chosen them to fulfill his purpose. So it was undeserved love shown by God to this nation. And God, having chosen this nation to be his own, will faithfully fulfill his promise to protect them and to provide for them. So provision has been given in their wilderness wandering up to this point. Their shoes did not wear out, their clothes did not wear out. They needed bread, bread fell from heaven, the manna from heaven. They needed water, water flowed from the rocks. See? Protection from the enemies. Pharaoh tried to chase after them, but were destroyed in the Red Sea. And then you discover that along the way, the Edomites tried to attack them, but God protected them. But now they were going to enter the Promised Land. And they had to fight wars like other people. See? And not only that, they also had to fulfill God's will in punishing these Amorite tribes or the Canaanites. See, all the tribes in Canaan were also known as Amorites after the name of the biggest tribe there. So they did not have war machines. In those days, chariots pulled by war horses were the equivalent of today's tanks. They could run fast, they could carry many soldiers, and some of them, one or two, will be controlling the horses and its direction, the direction of the chariots. Then others will be shooting with bow and arrow. Then others will be using their spear and sword to chop down the enemies as the chariots went into the midst of the enemies. But we must remember, the chariots in those days were equipped with blades around the wheels. And so as the chariots went through the enemies, the blades were turning around with the wheel and chopping down the enemies. So to have chariots pulled by war horses like that was like having tanks. And imagine you send soldiers, foot soldiers, to fight the army in tanks. No match. See? So the nation of Israel did not have soldiers riding horses, they have no chariots. So how were they going to win over bigger and stronger armies? God promised that he will give them the victory. They must fight by trusting in God and following his instructions. God wanted to use them as instruments, and God will give them the victory. Although they did not have such high-level type of weaponry at that time. See? So the high priest, or a priest specially assigned for the purpose, was to stand before the army before they engage in battle and to remind them not to be faint-hearted, not to be afraid, not to be terrified. And note that these were degrees of fear. See, when you are preparing for war, you hear that, ayo, the enemy is going to be is 10 times our size, and they have horses, they have chariots, then your heart becomes frightened. So the first stage of fear is being faint-hearted. Then as you march nearer, and before you clash with the enemy, you see them and you become afraid. So that is a higher level of fear. Then as the order is given for you to march forward to want to clash, wow, the Israelites will be terrified when they see the enemy is much stronger. So the priests who were giving, as it were, the exhortation before they went into battle was to take note of all this, that there were levels of fear. So do not let your heart be faint-hearted, do not be afraid, do not be terrified before your enemies. Okay? This is most likely going to happen to you. Verse 3, this is most likely going to happen to you once you go into battle. But the Lord will be on your side. He will fight for you against your enemies to save you. So you must trust in the Lord. Okay? So in this way, God strengthened his people, not wanting them to rear war horses, to build up an army made up of with war chariots and so on. No, Israel was never supposed to have all this. In latter days, King Solomon break this rule. He went astray in this. He, in his trading, he got rich, and then along the way he built up his army as well. And we know that he went astray in marrying many foreign wives as well. And then his heart was turned astray by his foreign wives. See? But according to the law of Moses, they were never to have cavalry. Remember, Jesus Christ died on the hill of Calvary. That is Calvary. But cavalry is the army on horses, cavalry, rather than Calvary. So you must listen very carefully. We are not talking about Calvary on which the Lord died. We are talking about cavalry. Cavalry is army on horses. So the Israelites were never to have cavalry or chariots. Okay? So they were assured of God's presence. God said, despite that, he will be present with his people. They must learn to trust in him, and they will have the victory. Yeah. And then in verse 5 to verse 9, you note that the army of Israel was to consist of soldiers and officers who were suitably qualified. And who were the soldiers who were qualified? See? Those not qualified were to be sent home. Some for what appeared to be legitimate reasons, because as we have noted, God is a God of compassion, and he doesn't need numbers to win. But he still wants the Israelites to fight the battle, because the sovereign God makes use of humans as instruments. He could bring things about miraculously without human instruments. He could, for example, today, if he wants people to be saved, he could just perform a miracle. And then all the pagan nations and all those who have been resisting the gospel so far, they will all be seeking the Lord, and they will be converted. God can perform a miracle, but it is not God's purpose to perform a miracle like that. See, God wants us, his people, to be his instruments, to bring the gospel to others. We say sometimes, you know, why doesn't God do it the easy way? He has the power, and he is able to perform miracles. Don't we believe that God can perform miracles? Of course, we do. But it's not God's purpose. He doesn't want us to just rely on him in a way which is childish, and in a way that is tempting him. It is he creates us with minds to think, with arms to work. See? So he wants to use us as instruments. And furthermore, in God's purpose, as we work for him, we serve him, he's actually changing us, he's strengthening us and making our faith stronger, trusting in him. So God, in his sovereignty, uses humans in his responsibility, in their responsibility. So humans are held responsible for their actions, but God is sovereign. So though you're held 100% responsible for your actions, you nevertheless must understand God's purpose will come to pass. So if you resist him, his purpose will still come to pass. His purpose will be carried out. But you will suffer for going against him. But if you go against God's will, how can his purpose be carried out? It will be carried out. Either God still uses your rebellion to bring about the purpose, or he will raise up others to carry out what he wanted you to do in the first place. You see, so God will be sovereign to fulfill his purpose, and we must try to fit into God's will, otherwise we will be very unhappy people. Okay? So understand this. The Christian life is about fitting into God's will. It is like the river flowing one direction. Why do you want to fight against the flow of the river? Why don't you study the flow of the river and then follow the stream? Why fight? You will never win. You see? So God wants us to know the flow of his will. From the Bible, we know what he wants us. Then we act according to his will. Then we will be happy people used by him to bring the gospel to others. So in this case, God did not need many soldiers to win battles. But he wanted to use soldiers to fight battles. So are you qualified to be in God's army? See, there are those who were left out for various reasons. In the days of Gideon, for example, the army of Israel was 32,000. But God trimmed down to just 300. So how did Gideon trim down the soldiers at that time? God told him, send the soldiers to the stream. Okay? First, those who are faint-hearted, like what is described here, faint-hearted, or who have legitimate reasons to go home, then they went. Yeah? So who are they? Those who have new houses, but they have not lived in the new houses yet. Okay, you go home. Since God is a compassionate God, he understands you're new in your career, you just started working and you are going to set up family, you just built a new house. You haven't dedicated it. In other words, you spent so much money and time building the house, but you haven't enjoyed it yet. God, in his compassion, said, you go home. I will use others to fight the battle. Okay? Then there are those who have planted vineyard, but you haven't harvested the grapes yet. You haven't enjoyed the fruit yet. So you spend so many months of back-breaking hard work. You plow the ground, you plant the grapes, and then the grapes haven't ripened yet. You haven't enjoyed the fruit yet. You go home. Go home and enjoy all the fruit of the labor. Then there were those who were betrothed, planning to get married, but haven't got married yet. God is kind. God said, okay, you go home. You don't have to fight the battle yet. One day you might be called up, but for the moment, you go home. Because God did not need to have big numbers to win the battle. Okay? And in the case of Gideon later on, in the time of Gideon, God further said, send the soldiers to the brook, to the stream, and make them drink. See? And we know the story, don't we? Huh? There were those, they were so, perhaps very thirsty. They ran to the stream and they put their face down again. The cool mountain stream, the water must have been so enjoyable. They just drink like dogs, see? So this was sent home. See? Others take up the water with their palms and they drink. See? Those were retained. And in the end, only 300 men were used by God, being led by Gideon to fight the enemies. See? Now you may ask, what's the difference between the two? It's God's way of testing the people. See? And we can see that those who just put their face down, they obviously lack that quality to be aware. Enemies can come and behind and just no need to chop off your head. They just take a hammer or take a stick, just whack you now and you are knocked out. But whereas those who scoop the water, they show a certain quality that they must be careful when enemies are around, they are ready. So we can explain it that way. But it also shows in daily life whether you are a person with class or not, or with carriage or not, you carry yourself well or not. See, so gospel work is interacting with people. So how do you carry yourself? So that's why it is important that we know how to interact with different types of people, how we you know, whether we generally we must be polite, generally we must be confident, because we know that we are going out in the name of our Lord, and also we must be compassionate. We go out, people can see from your countenance, from your face, and from the tone of your voice and how you say things, how convicting, how convincing you are, all comes through our person. So in everyday life, if you are a rough character who is not bothered about etiquette or protocol, you go to the office for an interview wearing sandals and wearing shorts and wearing your t-shirt, you expect to you want to prove yourself. Who are you trying to prove to? So when you are rejected during the interview, don't complain, you complain so much about, they're so unfair and this and that, But in the first place, you haven't revealed that you went there dressed in a singlet and shorts and sandals, and you expect to get the job. So if you were to go out in the name of Jesus Christ to proclaim the gospel like that, you expect to get a hearing. That's why even reaching out to the migrant workers, we say you must dress properly. You don't dress, wear a collarless t-shirt, you don't wear shorts. We wouldn't want to do outreach like that. So we must see that there are proper way of carrying ourselves. So in this case, there were this test being made to see who were qualified. But there is one category that we have not mentioned, verse 9. There were those who were fearful and faint-hearted. Fighting war, tremble, So if you, before fighting a battle, you are already fearful, it shows on your face. Perhaps you're sweating away, and the moment your name is called, you are trembling. So the officer have to say, "Are you afraid?" "Oh yes, sir." From the way you answer, from the tone of your voice, now you go home. Okay, you go home. You don't have to fight the battle. Because he's faint-hearted. He's not courageous. He's not suitable to go into battle. Now he will cause others to be fearful. That's one thing. Because fear is contagious. So even in ordinary life, without fighting battles, we're fighting other types of battles, not at war. You discover when people are fearful, fear spreads. And the other thing is, even those who are not fearful, they have the extra burden of taking care of those who are fearful. Well, you become a burden. We are fighting the enemy and now we have to take care of you. So these people were disqualified. They have to go home. So of course, today we are going to see as we go along that we don't fight literal battles with literal weapons today. We are fighting spiritual battle. We are doing the Lord's work. And in particular, we are carrying out the Great Commission. The gospel is to be brought to all the nations, to make disciples of them. Are we fit? Are we fit to be the soldiers of Jesus Christ in this spiritual battle? And not only that, in the church, people are placed in positions of responsibilities. Are we fit to take positions of responsibility? Then, of course, with time, officers in the church have to be appointed. Are you fit to be officers in the church? So each must know himself. And as a general rule, the more you are willing to serve the Lord, the more you come to the Lord and allow yourself to be molded, in all areas of your life. Just like working in a corporate firm, you don't just show yourself to be professionally capable, but you are social handicapped. Or you are in the family, you are a demon. An angel in church, but a demon at home. So you are going to be a disaster. So similarly, when we serve the Lord, make sure that all round we allow the Word of God to work in us. We want to be obedient to the Lord in every area of our life. We determine where we are strong. Be thankful for the Lord, for all your gifts and talents in these areas where you are strong. Bring to the Lord also the areas where you are weak. Perhaps you are unable to work with people. You are the type who always cause people to be upset. That type of weaknesses we bring to the Lord. Get things corrected in your family life. In a message like this, one or two here might, and there might be spoken to. This is where I've been lacking all these years. See, in church and outside, I appear to be well liked and well respected, but at home, you see, I haven't been behaving properly as a Christian man, Christian woman. Put things right, bring things before the Lord. It's never too late. For some, we should have learned all this long ago. See, but better late than never. Bring all our weaknesses to the Lord. Let Him correct us. Let the Spirit of God transform us in every area of our life so that we will be more ready to serve the Lord. Okay? Then in verse 9, the officers, after assessing those who are suitable to be in the army, now must appoint captains. Now a different word is used to show that these are leaders who are going to lead in battle. Okay? And therefore, they are people who require special qualifications. Okay? Just like in any area of society, in any area of life, see, leadership is needed. See, it has been said there are only leaders and followers in the world. See, in some areas we have to be followers, in some areas we are leaders. See, in the politics of the country, I never want to be in politics. Let the politicians run the country. See, so each in his own sphere. See, in the home, see, the man has to lead the family. Are you suited to lead the family? See, so each must know himself. See? There are structures of authority established by God for human society. In the home, we have parents as our authority. See, the disobedient child is sinning against God. See? When we go to school, the teachers are our authority. When you are at work, there are your supervisors, your managers, your CEOs. See? Now, you don't just go against them simply because you think yourself too smart. No. See, there are rules to follow. Yeah? Not all leaders function well, yeah? Function properly. Even civil authority, which is appointed by God, see? Romans chapter 13, they can do badly because they are not submitted to God. That can happen. But as a general rule, the government is placed there by God for our good. And so as a general rule, we should submit ourselves to the civil authority of our country. Okay? But at the point where the civil authority obviously breaks God's law, then at that point, we obey God rather than men. Yeah? So for example, if the government of this country were one day to say, we are totally not to reach out, bring the gospel to anyone, see, we will have to say sorry, we obey God rather than men. As it is now, there is a law which prevents us from bringing the gospel to a big sector of the population. We just have to say sorry, we don't submit to you in this area. See, but of course, we don't foolishly and openly go and break this law. You straight away go to jail, and then your usefulness is cut down. But in your heart, you must know you obey God, and this is an ungodly law, and therefore, don't obey that. See, wherever possible, quietly, do it. Bring the gospel to all communities in this country. See? There's the mistaken idea that we have freedom to practice, but we have no freedom to propagate our faith. To us, that is just make no sense. The Great Commission is very much part of our faith. So how can you say you practice your religion without propagating to others? So we really have to quietly say in our hearts, sorry, we obey God rather than man. Okay? So having said that, we take note that overall there are people who are suitably qualified, who are appointed to lead. So here in the battle, there were suitably qualified people who were appointed to lead. Okay? Then thirdly, the Israelites had to fight the Canaanites for reasons made known to them. They were reminded, first, because the Canaanites what is called haram. We have come across this word before. They were set aside for destruction because they have sinned against God for many generations. And when God first made the covenant with Abraham, he mentioned this, that his descendants will come and occupy this land. The reason is because the iniquity, the sin of the Amorites were not yet complete. Genesis chapter 15, verse 16. That means God was grieved with the sins of the Amorites. See? They have the law of God written in their hearts. In other words, all human beings have a sense of right and wrong in them. They have what we call conscience. And yet they sinned against God. They were killing their children as sacrifices to their false gods and things like that. They were committing sexual acts in the name of the religion. They were just having perversion of the worst kinds, just as in Sodom and Gomorrah in the days of Abraham. See? So they were getting worse and worse and worse. God was grieved and noting all this, but he was still waiting. And in the midst came Abraham. God called Abraham from Mesopotamia. Abraham came and interacted with them in their midst. So they have the opportunity of meeting a godly man, of hearing his teaching. Okay? And yet they did not repent. So God was going to destroy them when their iniquity was complete, when they reached the point where God had to act, otherwise God would not be truly just. So justice would require that their gross sin, when it reached its limit, had to be punished. And God, at the same time, was going to fulfill his covenant promise to Abraham that his descendants would occupy the promised land. So God was going to use the Israelites to be the instrument of judgment upon the Amorites. Okay? And therefore, we know that at that time, like it or not, they had to enter the promised land and fight the Amorites. Okay? Then later on, when they occupied the promised land, the surrounding nations were going to fight them and conquer them if they did not fight to defend themselves. See? So again, like it or not, when once they are settled, they have to be prepared for war. So all in all, people have struggled over how Christians should look at war. And as a general rule, evangelicals down the centuries have followed the summary of Augustine of Hippo. Augustine was a great theologian of the 5th century, and he summarized the occasions and when war may take place. He said, first, it must be for a just purpose, that is to end injustice and to restore peace. Second, it must be waged by a legitimate authority. Yeah? And thirdly, it must be conducted in a just and humane way. And this last point, to conduct war in a just and humane way, is hard to follow. And as mentioned earlier, in this part of the world, everyone of the previous generation will remember the Japanese occupation. See? And up to today, if you meet with older people, you talk to them, they will tell you there's still grievances in their heart. You say, no, why? This is past. To you, it's past, but they have experienced the atrocities of war, either in themselves or in their own family members or in their relatives. Say, so you heard of the rape of Nanjing. In Nanjing alone, you know, the Japanese soldiers went there and they competed with one another, chopping people's heads off. Say, and in one day, something like 200,000 were killed. 300,000 in total, but in that one day, and they chop, I say, in total, during that period, it was 300,000. But, you know, you just think, you know, but so how do you expect people of China to forgive and forget? See? It really, really is difficult. I want to tell you, I had an uncle. If he were alive today, he would probably be, let me see, close to 90. He would be close to 90 if he had been alive. But he died at age 17. And how did he die? My great-grandfather came from China and then settled in Kuching. See? He was a successful businessman. See? The Japanese soldiers march in. See? So he saw my uncle, hey, come, see? And then another man, come, see? okay, for entertainment of the army, you know, of the Japanese soldiers. They were told to knock head against head. So they have to knock. Say, not hard enough, move further back, knocked, not hard enough, knock. You see, and because of fear of being tortured by the Japanese, you see, so they bang their head, bang hard, you see. And the soldiers were just clapping, enjoying themselves, and then going away laughing, you see. Later, the family came, looked for him. They were all, the people, the workers were all very frightened, pointed to the toilet. So they went and opened there, and they saw him squatting there, crying. See, that night he went home, he died. Hemorrhage in the head. See, and that was my uncle. Okay. So we have cases like this. See? So we must understand that it is naive for us to just chase it away as though it's nothing. You think ignorance is bliss, then you can't interact with people, you can't understand them. But equally, don't go to the other extreme where you get so angry, and then the present generation of Japanese, you know, they're young people, they, you know, you treat them roughly, you know. Of course, there's a measure of bearing the responsibility of the sins of the previous generation, but biblically speaking, you see, the son should bear his own sin and not the sin of his father. Okay? And so, while from the historical point of view, this has to be taught and this has to be made known and lessons have to be learned. Okay? But we don't go to the extreme of blaming the present generation as though they are the ones who committed those atrocities. Okay? So these are things that we have to learn as we go along. War brings out the worst in men. And God was giving these laws in order to contain the possible atrocities that would be committed by God's own people. So God is saying, you must remember, see, you are the chosen people of God. You cannot behave like other people. So these laws were given in order to contain the likelihood that they would behave like other people. See? So today, we have what is called the Geneva Convention. After the First World War and Second World War, the United Nations, they got together, then they have what is called the Geneva Convention. So when wars are fought, see, then when you have to treat your prisoners of war humanely, there are certain things you could do, certain things you couldn't do. See? But of course, most people behind the scene, away from the public eye, they commit a lot of atrocities. Then when the war is over, there will be a tribunal, all this will be dug out, and if there are proofs, then those people will have to be punished accordingly. Okay? So to some degree, it's mitigated, but human beings being what we are, when there's no law and no eyes watching us, the worst in us will come out. Okay? So as far as war is Christians are concerned, war may be participated in. Our confession of faith says that also to maintain justice and peace, they, the Christians, may lawfully, under the New Testament, engage in war if it is just and essential. This is in the 1689 Confession, chapter 24, verse 2. So if you want to join the army and you struggle over this, I'm a Christian, should I? You know, I like the army life, I like the discipline. So we say, go ahead. See, it's a good profession. See, but what if war takes place? I will have to fight and kill. If it is a just war, we really have to go all out and fight. But how do we determine a just war? This is where most of us are not in the positions to do so. A higher authority, government, when they declare war against one another, there are so many issues which we are not privy to. We don't have the privilege of knowing. See, but what we do know is that our government is at war with another government. So, therefore, we are citizens of this country. Fight well. Fight well. If you are in the army, fight well. And if I am your father, I would say, fight well and shoot them to kill. See, that way you are more likely to survive. You say, oh, show compassion on the field. know, you're not going to you're not likely to survive. You know, imagine you show compassion when the enemy is there, you'll be shot. See, they don't think like that during a battle. You know, see, it's either they die or you die. Therefore, in a battle, you don't show compassion in the wrong way at the wrong time. See, so we must be clear on this. Otherwise, you know, your children are not likely to survive. If you are squeamish, you are unclear, and you are so mixed up, you know, and you send a mixed signal to them, they are taught things that are vague, and they go into battle so unclear about what it means to be a Christian in the army, that we say no. See, it is not wrong to be in the army, and if a war breaks out, fight for your country, fight well. Okay? Then we come to the second part, the conduct of war. Now, verse 10 to verse 20. When you go out to war against your enemies, we are told that, see? when you go near a city to fight against it, then proclaim an offer of peace to it. When they approach any city, proclaim peace if they will surrender. See, since you have to attack, okay? But you are out at war. War has been declared. You are out to fight. So you approach a city first. See, surrender or not. See, if the city surrenders, then you don't kill any one of them and make them work for you. In other words, you see, there are so many things to be done. You can't allow them to fight you from behind. Huh? You can't enter the city, okay, shake hands, you know, we are friends. Huh? You see, and walk away, and then behind your back, they attack you. You can't allow that to happen. War is war. See, so be wise, be smart. You see, make them part of the war now. Now together we fight our enemies. So since you surrender, then you have to do what you can. So put them to work in that war itself. See? So that is part and parcel of war. See? And if the city refuses to surrender, you begin to attack. And since the Lord has promised success, they will win. See? They must trust the Lord and follow God's direction, and along the way they will win over the city. See, as they enter the promised land. See? So what will happen then? When the city is defeated, then all the men were to be killed. Say again, you say, "Ayo, it's not killing. They are defeated. Why kill some more?" But this is God's instruction. God knows better than you, and God is more compassionate than your feeling of compassion at the wrong time. This is not the time to feel compassion. Say, and just like the earlier example, you say you show compassion in the wrong way, then these men turn around to attack you from behind. They are the infiltrators, and they come and cause havoc in the army camp. No. So God's command is you kill all the men, leave all the children and the women alive. And together with the things, these are your plunder. See? How to deal with this, we will come to that in the next chapter. See? But for the moment, see, take note that the rules of war are such that if you have defeated that city, the people and the things that remain belong to the victor. See? So you harness them to whatever is needed, and normally they become part of the army. See? Either they actually take up arms or train to fight, or more commonly, they are made to do the manual work. For example, to cook for the soldiers, to draw water, to do all the manual work. See, because some people have to do that, because a war can be fought for a long time. See, a battle can take long. See, a war consists of many battles, and each battle may take a long time to complete. See, so food is needed. People need to sleep, so some will be on guard. Clothes needs to be washed. People need to go to the toilet. So in a battlefield, there will be places where you have to do all this. See, so who are to deal with all this? See, so there will be people assigned to take care of the waste, people who wash the clothes, people who cook, and so on. So this will be assigned to work for the army like that. Okay? And again, you see, the idea of killing the fighting man was also to prevent the enemies rising up too quickly. The children would be spared, but by the time the children grow up, it is hoped that that would be long enough time for things to settle down and the war would be over. The idea is to prevent immediately for the enemies to launch a counterattack. Okay? So take note that we are talking about war, not peacetime, and therefore the rules of war apply. Then the second point under this section is that the cities of Canaan were to be completely destroyed because they were haram. It's similar to the Arabic word haram, haram here. We have come across this word before in chapter 7, verse 2 to 4. In other words, the Canaanite tribes have sinned beyond what is decent, beyond decency, and God has been long-suffering. He has been patient with them for a long time until their sin really cried out for judgment. God cannot tolerate that anymore. Otherwise, he will not be the just God that he is. Therefore, God had to punish these Canaanite tribes. So they are set aside for destruction. It is like there's no hope for these people anymore. Their hearts have turned so crooked and perverse that there's no likelihood of putting them right anymore. You say, but God is all-powerful. By a miracle, he can change them. Again, don't talk like that. See, in God's plan, in God's purpose, he wants us humans to act responsibly. So in the case of the Israelites, they mustn't raise questions like this. God, by your almighty power, you can change their hearts. See, no. God has been patient with them for over 400 years. They have sinned. They sinned against God. See? And remember the influence of people like Abraham there, Lot also. And remember, Abraham and Lot were not the only godly people around at that time. According to Bible scholars, there were families who were godly at that time since the days of Adam, since the day of Noah. Job, for example, was a godly man in the Far East at that time, near to what is present-day northern, around about Syria, that region. Okay? So, Job, the book of Job, yeah. So, Job, the godly Job, so, he, as far as we know, he's not related directly to Abraham. Abraham was, he's from your direction, you see, the river, the river flows, Tigris and Euphrates. Terah was moved to a place called Haran in North Syria, Mesopotamia, Iraq, today's Iraq. They moved to Haran. See? Then Terah died. Abraham was called by God. He moved down south to the Promised Land. Now, around that region, close to it, this side, is supposed to be the area where Job lived. So there were godly families here and there. Abraham went to rescue his nephew Lot. Remember, he came back, he met Melchizedek, the high priest of God. See, where he's from, we don't know. Where he went after that, we don't know. But we know that there was such an individual who was high priest of the true God. See, now who did he minister to? Surely there are godly families around whom he ministered to. See, so we are not given the information of that time. The human race has spread. A number of godly families were here and there. See, others have been influenced by paganism and gone their own way. See, Abraham was called out of this situation where God made a covenant with him, and through his descendants would come the Savior who would die on a cross to save his people. See, so that was God's plan. But what needs to be noted is that these Canaanites had been given their chance for a long, long time to turn back to God, but they did not. Therefore, they were haram. So the word haram is like the Arabic word haram, harem, haram, yeah? Because they are Semitic languages. Yeah? From the Noah's time, one of his sons was Shem, the Shemitic people. The Isaac and Ishmael. Isaac was the father of the Jews. Ishmael is supposed to be the father of the Arabs. See? So they were from the same root. That's why their language, their languages bear resemblance to one another, although written differently. But you see, they are pronounced the same way. Their alphabets, Aleph, Beth, Gimel, Dalet, you know, in Hebrew, you see, has their equivalent in Arabic. Mm-hmm. So those of us who learn a bit of Jawi, it's the same. Aleph, Beth, Ter, Sir, Jim, Cher, we learn all this when young. Then there are words for prophet, Nabi. It's similar to Nabi. So there are similarities. So harem is haram. So you know from the Arabs and the Muslims, and then came to Southeast Asia, then we adopted the word haram, ceremonially haram, unclean. See? So these people were najis already, haram already. They were set apart to be destroyed, totally destroyed, set aside for God to judge. See? And then, of course, verse 18 tells us another reason is for the good of God's chosen people. If they were to be left around, they will pollute the land with their religion. See? And for us today, we learn the principle that although we don't fight our enemies with literal sword, today we preach the gospel. By the power of the Spirit, God's people will be called out of the world. Okay? But the principles remain for those who want to serve the Lord. For those who are God's people, we must uphold moral purity, we must uphold spiritual purity. So in the church, we cannot allow sin to be tolerated. It's not that we are harsh or what, but when there are sins, you know, and the church just sweep the sin aside, see, and then that is not right, not right. See? That's why church discipline has to be carried out. See? No society can survive long if there's no discipline. Okay? So in the church, in our church, we believe in three levels of discipline. First, admonition. So we admonish a person, we talk to the person to correct him. See? When that doesn't work, we have to suspend him. That means his privileges and responsibilities are taken away. Okay? So you know, in the church, privileges like attending the Lord's Supper. If the person is stubborn and continue to run his own way, for example, gossiping and spreading slander, false things about the pastor or about the church or what, you see, when it becomes so obvious and we talk to the person still continues, then we have to say, you know, if you don't change, we really have to carry out the next step. And the next step is that they cannot attend the Lord's Supper, and all positions of responsibility will be taken away. For example, if they are teaching Sunday school, we say stop teaching. They're not qualified to teach until you put things right. And if the person is stubborn and rebellious and cause more problem, the time has come when the church has to remove him from membership and we treat the person as a non-Christian. He might profess to be a Christian, but his behavior doesn't show so. See? So we have to, as it were, deliver him back to Satan. See? That means he's now treated as a non-believer and he's excommunicated. So these are the three levels of church discipline in the church. And this is only one area of church life. Other areas which are more commonly noted is outreach, fellowship, worship, and it's a church camp, conferences and so on. We see these various other areas, but we forget that under church government there is this area called church discipline. And quietly the church has to exercise discipline. If the church fails in church discipline and allow sin to be hidden away, to fester, then soon the rot will come in. Yeah? And it happens in the family, it happens in society, in the nation as well. The rot comes in, the nation is destroyed. See? So something has to be done. Yeah? So far better to deal with the problems as it arises than to keep it and allow it to fester, and then finally you want to have to clean it up, it becomes much more difficult. Okay? So the Lord is never pleased with a church that does not deal with sin. Okay? And this is not that we are harsh, and this is not that we are perfect. Okay? We are normal people. We are joyful. We want to cultivate joyful Christianity. But joyful Christianity must be there only when there's such a thing as church discipline. So any church that is joyful, if it doesn't have have church discipline, before too long it becomes anarchy, it becomes worldly. Outwardly people are happy, jolly, and the church may be growing in numbers, but it's rotting from within. What's the point? So we must be very careful. God has eyes to see. The Bible is clear enough on all this. We must practice separation from the world. See? So we are in the world, but we are not of the world. Then the third point is this. Whether against cities in Canaan or elsewhere, the trees had to be spared from destruction, verse 19 to verse 20. And this sounds a bit odd. But again, you see, naive people would think, why are you so concerned about trees? You're asking enemies to be killed. That means you are more concerned about trees than about people. Now that type of reasoning is really unbalanced, disproportionate type of reasoning. It is perverse reasoning. Now people has been dealt with in the earlier verses. Only these last two verses has to do with trees. Look at it in proportion. It's only these two last verses. How many verses has been spent on people already? So don't say that God is interested more in trees than in people. No, rules have been given concerning how to conduct themselves in war. God knew that his people will be like other people if there's no restraint. So the worst in us will come out. So God gave rules to contain the evils of necessary war. War is necessary. At times, even today, wars might be necessary. At that time, like it or not, if you don't fight, people fight you. And this is where food supply, hygiene, and things like that has to be thought of. And then you see, you use what you have as you go along. Even in modern warfare, you see, of course, one nuclear bomb, you bomb up everything. That has yet to be tested out. Still, people would not use the atomic bomb and the nuclear bomb. So some degree of conventional fighting has to be involved. We use guns, we use tanks, the army has to proceed and then conquer territory, and the army proceed. But as the army proceeds, what if the food supply is not there? Then soon your army will be weak and cannot fight anymore. These are basic things. As you proceed, you don't destroy the food supply, the water supply, you see? And if you read Sun Tzu's Art of War, you know, you use fire, you use the terrain, you use spice, you use the food supply, all these are involved. So don't overlook even basic things like this. And furthermore, what victory are you winning if the whole place is devastated? You win the war, but the whole place is devastated. So where do you begin? See, the water is polluted, so where do you find water? All the plants are dead, so where do you start? See, all the buildings are totally destroyed. So you win a war that actually is not a victory. You win actually all this destruction. See? So God is trying to introduce sanity even in war. You know, the trees you don't simply chop down if they produce food. But in war you need wood and battering rams, especially to knock down the city walls. Now those trees that don't bear fruit, that are not food to you, you can use those trees for war purpose. Okay. And of course, back of all this is the fact that God created all things, including the animals and the trees, and the mountains and the streams. See? So don't forget that. God did not just create humans. Humans were created as the highest of God's creation, but He's the highest of all God's creation. There were all other things that were created by God, and He created all things very good. So therefore, if you have the heart of God, you would want peace, not war. And when war is fought, you have to remember, don't destroy everything, and even the trees, even the surroundings, because the heart of God is that He values all things that He has created. And of course, if we have time, we will extend this principle to everyday living as well. See? So in the place where we live, we don't live like a cow shed or like a, you know, we have an expression, a dog's den, dirty and untidy and disorganized. No, when converted, you naturally want to be orderly. 1 Corinthians 14, verse 40, in worship, the one principle is it must, everything must be done decently and in order. See, God is a God of order. See, He created in 6 days, 7 days He rested. He didn't simply create in any day. No, there was a definite order. First day He created what? Second day He created what? Third He created what? So when you're converted, you also become orderly and decent and systematic. Okay? The room you live in, it must be orderly. And when you are cooking in the kitchen, the utensils must be orderly. Then when you sleep in a bedroom, the bedroom must be orderly. When you wake up, fold your blankets, put the things properly. Yeah? You can't be like other people. See, when converted, all this are reflected in your life as well. Okay? So we take note that this covers the application to this general situation concerning war. Now, as we draw to a close, we note some closing applications. Just wars might need to be fought, in which case we must fight well for victory, to gain victory. We don't fight half-heartedly. Fight to win. Otherwise, you're more likely to die. See? Although our life is in God's hand, but we do have to see that this is where the more likely to survive is the one who really fight well during a war. See? So one day, if you have children or grandchildren in the army and the war takes place, teach them correctly. Then the church is fighting a spiritual battle, not with literal swords, but with the sword of the Spirit, which is the Word of God. We must put on the whole armor of God, yeah, while we trust in the Lord's presence, who will give the victory. Yeah. So God tells us to put on the whole armor as described in Ephesians 6. So don't just put on one piece of the armor. The whole armor must be put on faith and the Word of God and prayer. All this must be included. Then finally, spiritual qualifications are needed to serve in God's army, whether in the officer's capacity or as a fighting soldier. We serve under our chief shepherd in accordance to His word. His word is sufficient for us. His Spirit dwells in us. And we must always remember that Christ is our chief shepherd. So in closing, we note that justice and mercy, zeal and compassion go hand in hand as we serve the Lord.